gentlemen. First case for argument this morning is Rising Moore against Red Roof Inns. Mr. Gray.
Your Honor, may it please the court, good morning. Appellant Mr. Rising Moore maintains that the district court's decision granting summary judgment in favor of Appley Red Roof Inns on his negligence claim was an error for two reasons. First, the lower court found, as a matter of law, that Red Roof Inn had not breached its duty of care that it owed to Mr. Rising Moore. That question should have been answered by the jury, not by the court. Second, this case should have been remanded to state court since the jurisdictional amount in controversy was not established with reasonable probability. One of the parties' disagreements centers on what is a question of law and what is a question of fact. Since at least 1884, Indiana courts have recognized that business owners owe an obligation to its invitees to keep its premises free from dangerous obstructions or pitfalls that may harm its invitees. Indeed,
Mr. Gray,
ma'am.
Maybe it would be helpful if you addressed your jurisdictional argument first, since obviously, I assume the reason you're making it, in a sense, is it would mean all of this is beside the point. And my question really is, even if the letter with the assessment of the potential value of the case that was sent earlier or the stipulation weren't taken into account, why wasn't the district court judge here entitled to look at the nature of the claim and to see that the damages, even so far, it's the type of case that usually ends up more than $75,000. Depends a little bit on how you want to apply these various, reasonable probability or the St. Paul test, but I'd like some discussion of that, please.
Certainly, Your Honor. The facts, as I view that, that the district court, not the allegations in the complaint, but the facts that the district court had to base its decision upon reasonable probability were, first, the early on demand for approximately $160,000.
But there was also a separate element of that letter, which was a range of assessment for the value of the case, which was different. Actually, it was higher than the
proposed
settlement amount. But normally we think lawyers speak for their clients. It's an agency relationship. Why wasn't the district court entitled to take that estimated range into account?
Well, the court certainly was entitled to take that into account, but I think the more significant evidence was that of the later demand, just before the complaint was filed, for $60,000. Also,
it was a demand in settlement.
That's correct.
That is, it was compromising differences. We know that tort cases, when they go to judgment, the plaintiff wins about half the time and the defendant wins about half the time. So $60,000 as a compromise amount implies that the controversy is $120,000, because that's what the plaintiff would expect to get if he won outright. Why isn't that $60,000 demand just about the most powerful support for the district court's view?
Well, it's a demand prior to trial, Your Honor, and I think most plaintiff's counsels prior to trial are willing to discount their claim to a certain extent.
Yeah,
so they
exactly.
Don't.
That's the point. We need to know the amount in controversy, which is how much is it plausible to think that the plaintiff might get if he won at trial.
So
if $60,000 is the discount, then the amount in controversy almost certainly is over $75,000.
Well,
unless you thought this was a dead bang winner, right? A no lose case.
I've not seen one of those, Your Honor, in quite some
exactly.
time. I also think that the other evidence, the hard and fast evidence that we had, were medical expenses of the nature of $10,800, which does not, in my mind, connote that for certain that there would be a claim in excess of $75,000 for that.
But that wasn't the only thing. There was that plus evidence of 45 days of inability to work, and whether somebody is a wage employee or a salaried employee or a self-employed individual mm-hmm. with an implicit income, there is an earning capacity, just to use a different word, that the district court could also take into account. So there were a number of factors there suggesting that this head injury, which Mr. Rising Moore asserted was a very serious head injury.
Certainly.
The district court is certainly entitled to take that into account, could have long-term effects on that earning capacity. Again, no matter how one pays oneself, just to say you aren't employed by somebody else doesn't mean you don't have earning capacity.
Correct, Your Honor. I also do believe that it is significant that the removal statute itself does provide for a period of up to 1 year after filing within which one can, through discovery, determine what is the amount in controversy and then petition for removal.
Well, look, there's all sorts of evidence that I can imagine that somebody might have put in this record. There are lots of studies, for example, of high, low, and median verdicts for different kinds of cases. You could probably do slip and fall plus ice, and figure mm-hmm. out what those numbers are like. I had the sense that the district court judge, who's a very experienced judge, had seen more than one of these and was aware that they tend to have a certain value. Maybe there could have been more evidence, but I suppose our question is, did there have to be in order to keep this from a jurisdictional standpoint here?
I don't think there has to be, Your Honor. I think the reasonable probability does leave quite a bit of leeway to the district court. It is not does not require proof positive of that amount. But I think, if I may go back to the original argument that I was making,
sure.
I think
That's
what
fine.
Does require proof positive is that there was a duty owed to Mr. Risingmore.
On that part of
yes.
the case, what interests me is whether... As I often actually have the impression, your briefs, all of the briefs, struck me as a bit of ships passing in the night, because you are arguing, it seems to me, a failure of procedure on part of Red Roof Inns, procedures for listening to the weather, procedures for checking periodically, because that's the only way I can see the 2 or 3 hour time frame being relevant, whereas Red Roof is saying, look, Mr. Risingmore himself said there was no ice on the ramp at the time he walked in, and surely you don't think they have a duty to race out every 15 seconds and check to see whether ice has appeared. So, what duty we're talking about or what the failing is important.
Your Honor, my specific point is exactly that. Whether or not it's 15 minutes, 5 minutes, 3 hours, that's a decision for the jury to make. Not for the court. And what the court said here was 20 minutes, as a matter of law, is too short a period of time. I don't think that is the law. I think the law is that is once the duty is established, it's the trier of fact's judgment.
20 minutes from what?
20 minutes. Mr. Risingmore was in the facility for 20 minutes.
20 minutes from the time that he went in when there wasn't a problem.
He noticed no problem when he entered.
So it's 20 minutes with no... notice of a problem.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then 20 minutes later, then they know there's a problem.
What is
the interim? What is it that's supposed to alert someone to a duty to do something?
Well,
the facts in this case.
In this case, the one of the attendants stated that she had, one of the previous attendants stated that she had thought somebody had already put ice melt on the pavement. So they were aware that the weather conditions were deteriorating substantially. And so I think that put them on notice that there was a problem, or should have, the trier of fact could have easily determined that that was a problem that should have been addressed by the innkeeper. I see my time light is on, and I would like to save my remaining for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Greider. Mr. Abrahamson.
Court, please. Counsel, with regard to the removal. I certainly would never want to be in a position, as counsel suggests, to wait a year during the discovery and then say, you know what, I think we now have some answers to interrogatories, we have this, we have this, we have this, and then file a notice of removal and be confronted with the situation that would say, you were served with a complaint.
But I guess the issue that bothers me about this, Mr. Abrahamson, is that, you're the defendant. You can look at this and decide to remove, as you did, and you're making the various assertions. But now you're the party who is asserting that federal jurisdiction exists. And then you're faced with a challenge where the other side, the plaintiff, comes in and says, we are going to put you to your proof that the jurisdictional amount is satisfied. And it's at that point where you didn't show very much. I mean, there are these little amounts, the $10,000, the 45 days off, and even if you, as I did, adjust for the fact that it's probably more like a 270-day year, not a 365-day year, it still doesn't get you much above $32,000 or $34,000. And you're showing, it strikes me, is very skimpy when the burden of proof is on the party asserting jurisdiction.
Well, with a complaint that says that this man, and evidence that substantiates a closed head injury.
But where, you're making an assumption which may be perfectly reasonable in light of all of your experience, but we need evidence in cases. And maybe, like, we all know that head injuries are serious, but does serious mean $60,000, or does serious mean $1 million? I mean, where's the number?
Well, I don't know where. There is no number. There is no number, obviously, because of the rule that says you can't put a number in your complaint.
Well, in Indiana, but then once you're in the federal court and jurisdiction has been challenged, the federal court's entitled to take evidence on that point.
Well, we believe, and Judge Barker in her decision indicated that this gentleman who alleged that he was unable to work, that he'd missed time from work, and that when his deposition was taken after the removal, was unable to go about his business, and with regard to his income, I believe his tax returns would show that a very, very substantial portion of that was, in fact, wage income supported by W-2s, with a complaint of a closed head injury, neurological deficits, and permanent injuries. I would never want to be in a position of saying, in my opinion, our exposure in this case does not reach $75,000, because I think the client would be looking for another lawyer pretty quick. I think that's where we are in this case. And with all due respect to counsel, the the question of the $60,000 settlement is with all, I think Mr. Price is a very honorable lawyer. He's not here today. And if he says he recalls a conversation, far be it from me to say that conversation never took place. All I can tell you is there's nothing in the file to substantiate that. And that first time that was mentioned was in a letter denying, in response to a request to stipulate that the damages do not exceed $75,000. Dear Harold, I'm sorry, I can't sign your stipulation. I seem to recall a conversation with the adjuster where I tried to get him to do this, and by the way, when are we going to take that 30B6 deposition that I've been talking about? That is the only place in the record where there is any suggestion about, you know, if you want to wrap this case up before I file suit, we'll take 60. There's absolutely nothing in the file to that extent. Nothing. So I believe that the burden that we have is to establish a reasonable probability that the amount in controversy is $75,000. And another issue that was raised in the briefs but not argued this morning has to do with where this court sits with regard to that matter. Counsel argues in their brief that this is a de novo review. The leading case, as far as we've been able to find, is Rexford case, which has been followed numerous times by this court, and as far as I know, never deviated, says that when it's a fact-specific inquiry, this court reviews that decision to determine whether or not there's clear error.
Okay. Before your time runs out, I would appreciate your commenting on the other side of this case, the duty side, because it does seem to me that this really turns on whether the duty that's being asserted is the duty to run out and sprinkle ice melt, or whether the failure is to sprinkle the ice melt, or whether the failure is to have in place a set of reliable procedures that a business that can expect visitors in the middle of the night, business invitees, has, so that, you know, to monitor the weather and to go out and check periodically and to take perhaps even preventive measures. You can sprinkle that stuff on before the ice begins, and it actually has the same effect.
Okay. On that subject, the plaintiff's position is through the depositions that, well, there was not a printed set of rules posted in the office as to what to do.
Right, and in fact, no one seemed to know what was happening, well, since the desk clerk thought that it had already been done.
I'm sorry. And the desk clerk on duty, the night auditor, Mary Prather, in her deposition, and she was interviewed, she was interviewed ex parte by plaintiff's counsel after the lawsuit was filed, and she had left the employ. She was on a disability and was unable to work. Both in her ex parte interview and in her deposition, she said, "I didn't need a list of written instructions. I had been a manager for 7 years of a Dollar Inn across the street. I knew what to do. We had the ice there. I mean, the ice melt.
Sure.
If it was necessary, we'd have put it out. As far as I was concerned, I came on duty an hour earlier. There was no need to put it out." Bobby Harris, who was the off-duty policeman who worked as a security guard, who also was interviewed ex parte by plaintiff's counsel before the suit was filed, said, "The first thing I do when I come on duty is I walk the premises." And the Exhibit A to his deposition indicates his check sheet that says at 11:30 he walked the premises, took no exceptions whatsoever, and said as far as he's concerned, it appeared to him that the plaintiff was in for 5 minutes. Now, whether he's in for 5 minutes or 20 minutes, the plaintiff is entitled to the benefit, and I assume the plaintiff wants him to be in there as long as possible. Mary Prather said, as far as she was concerned, he was in and out. There was no evidence that there was anybody else in the motel at that time. At 11 o'clock, they locked the door, and they go through a night window. But she said, "I knew Mr. Rising Moore. He stayed here a couple times a week, so I let him into the office, gave him a key." Mr. Rising Moore testified when he came in, no problem going up the ramp whatsoever. No problem. No evidence whatsoever that Mr. Rising Moore said, "Mary, you know, it's getting nasty out there. You better throw some salt." Zero. No evidence whatsoever. So this happened in a very short period of time. And Robbie Harris also indicated that in addition to his security guard duties, that he also acted as a night porter.
Right, but that's why I'm thinking that the difference is really whether the duty is to anticipate or whether motels in Indiana get to have one person fall down and then go out and sprinkle the ice on first. I mean, if the duty is to anticipate and the weather reports are saying the weather's going to deteriorate tonight, I guess it's just a different case in my mind if there is a duty to anticipate.
Well, and there are serious questions in my based on the record, there are serious questions as to whether that was in fact happening. What Mr. Rising Moore said was that he heard weather reports that the weather south, he's in Indianapolis, he lives in a place called Bloomfield, which is 50 or 60 miles southwest of Indianapolis, part of which includes traveling on not interstate highways, that they were anticipating bad weather, so he decided to stay overnight. That's what the evidence is in the record. Mm-hmm. Not that a Motel 6 employee should have been listening to something or watching something or looking out the window long time ago when we had Faye Flynn. P.J. Hoff was the weatherman, and he always said the vice president in charge of looking out the window says it's raining. Mm-hmm. But we don't have anything like that here. We have nothing. We have a plaintiff that says, "When I walked in, everything was fine. I checked in, got my key, and I walked out, and I slipped and fell." That's all there is here. That's all there is. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Abramson. Anything further, Mr. Gray?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, the evidence in the record does establish that Mr. Rising Moore noticed that his windshield was icing up as he was driving into the hotel parking lot. So we are entitled to that inference or that evidence as well. Also, I wanted to mention the district court and defendant make much of the case Orth v. Smedley, a 1978 Indiana decision, which I think is very distinguishable on its facts. In that situation, it was a landlord, not an innkeeper, and the landlord lived in Mitchell, Indiana, 23 miles from where the leased premises were located in Salem, Indiana. There the court said because it iced up in the night when the landlord was not present, there was no duty or the duty was not breached. This is an entirely different situation. This is an inn run by innkeepers. They're there 24 hours a day. It's their responsibility to keep their guests safe. That didn't happen in this case, and the jury was entitled to make the decision as to whether or not that duty was breached. If there's no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.